You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for tuning in to Americana Music Profiles. It's Season 3, brought to you by Americana Rhythm Music Magazine in print and AmericanaMusicMagazine.com online. I'm your host, Greg Tutwiler. Let's join in on another great conversation with one of the Americana music industry's super talented artists. Former record store owner Mike Felton has parlayed the end of 30-plus years of selling vinyl into a singer-songwriter career full-time. He is my guest on this episode of Americana Music Profiles as we talk about his new CD, Diamonds and Televisions. Well, hi, Mike. Welcome to the podcast. It's good to get a chance to talk to you today.
Yeah, great. I'm glad to hear from you.
So you've actually been at this quite a while.
Yeah, I guess. When you stop and think about it, if you want to go back, really my entire life I've been involved in music some way, shape, or form. But, I did have a record store starting in 1979, running for about 30 years. Had them in a couple states. We were online. I used to do record shows, load up the car, and we drove everywhere, actually, from Virginia to California to Texas to Minnesota. We've been everywhere.
What was the name of your store?
It was the Record Emporium.
Okay. Yep. That definitely sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Are you doing any of that at all anymore?
No, not really. It's we closed the store. It had to be about 2008, and we went to a warehouse and did it. We were exclusively online for a while, and sold most of our inventory off. Before the warehouse burned down.
Oh, no.
So, wow. We were out of there by then, but yeah. It was just like the place, the building had been condemned, and we had been sharing space with a record company and a T-shirt company and all these bands, and everybody had little offices there, and one by one, they all went out of business, and I was... like the last one in this whole warehouse, and the city finally came and condemned the warehouse for.
Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe people had been there, had been a different thing, but they kind of let it fall into disrepair.
Sure.
And, it was kind of like The Shining. I'm sitting up there by myself in this huge warehouse.
Kind of a poetic. Ending not just to a business and a building, but an era as well. It sounds like there might be a song in there somewhere.
Yeah, well, they actually did a documentary called Revinalized. A guy named John Boston did it. And we were in there along with a couple other record stores that were still functioning at the time. And I don't think maybe one or two of them are still there. But
yeah, wow.
But you can get that online. That's 20 minutes on YouTube. So
okay, well that's
see what I look like.
Sure, yeah. Well, that's a nice side trail. Of course, you know, there's a. I'm not sure we can call it a revitalization, but there's certainly a renewed interest in vinyl, and I'd love to see it be something that comes back and stays. I'm afraid it's a fad, but it's nice to at least to hear people talk about it again.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to a record convention on Sunday. On my second one since I've quit, but I've been enjoying playing music, as far as playing old albums and CDs lately.
Yeah.
I have thousands and thousands of things that I'm rediscovering and never had the time to spend with them, but I do now.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. So we're obviously not on the call to necessarily talk about the record business, but you've been in the business in other fashions for perhaps quite as long as a musician and entertainer. Tell me about that side of your life and how you got involved in and becoming a musician.
Way back in the 60s, that's a long time ago, but took my first guitar lessons at the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago, at a previous location, not the new one. It was a second floor walk up, and some of the guys that had founded were still there, and I know it was, you know, I was kind of a kid from the north side of Chicago, and going down and seeing these bohemian ladies in their black dresses, and kind of the ex-beatnik era.
Yeah,
it was kind of eye-opening for me. But as always, kind of got to be a fan of Woody Guthrie and all the old folky guys, and I learned all those songs from there. And of course, it was rock and roll, and you wanted something electric.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into rock bands in 65, 66, and I was just playing around with the song Hey Joe, because I was doing that before Jimi Hendrix got a hold of it.
Wow, that's cool.
That group called The Leaves had it, and Love had it out. It was a little up-tempo. So we got into rock bands. I was with a band called the Bogus Risque Weeds for a couple years. Got into playing solo across from the Old Town School. There was a place called the Fifth Peg, where guys like Steve Goodman and John Prine and you used to just wander in and play an open mic, and I used to do those. And,
that's cool.
We used to do a couple open mics on Tuesday nights, I remember, and do about three of them, go down to Orphans. There's a place called the Saddle Club, but just started with that. Always was interested in the blues. Put on a probably the first outdoor music festival in Chicago when I was in junior college. That had to be about 70, 71. And we had Buddy Guy and Junior Wells play, and we got to meet, we actually went to Muddy Waters' house because he was that accessible at that time. He could just
call up
and go over and visit. And he had been in a car wreck and had a broken leg at the time, so he couldn't get away from us, so he he called a Buddy Guy to get rid of us, and Buddy took us to a couple blues clubs, and that was a night I always remember. We go to a club, I forget which one it was, but Willie Dixon was there, and Junior Wells.
Oh, cool.
And it's just like everybody who was everybody.
Yeah.
Just sitting around on a Tuesday night. But I did play in some blues bands. I got married in 76. We went back to the land, like a lot of people did, and I played in cover bands for a long time up there, and did some of the folk festivals, Hiawatha, uh-huh. Rhinelander, Pike Lake, doing a lot of those up there. But the cover bands paid the bills. We were playing 7 days a week, 4 hours a day, and 6 hours on Sunday. And
wow.
Kind of learn your chops from doing that.
Sure,
Then I got back to Chicago. It was kind of exclusively, it wasn't exclusively, it was blues bands, and I found myself in a heavy metal band playing bass for a short time called Lobotomy. And that was fun, and I'm still in contact with those guys, and they're on to different things.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I've always had a hand in about 2003. Ran into some people. I had a recording studio, and I had a bunch of songs, and Acme Recording was a couple blocks away from one of our stores.
Uh-huh.
So I wound up going in there after hours and recording my first CD called Landfill. And that was kind of a learning experience. But that was in 2003, and I've been working on albums ever since. So this new one, Diamonds and Televisions, will be, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. About the fifth one, the fourth one I actually recorded in the studio, but there was a live one called No Second Rides. So there have been four studio albums and one live one. As maybe by the time you get this in print or on the air, I'll have a couple of outtake collections that'll be available online.
Okay.
I'm working on the next one.
Sure. Yeah. Good. So how did the record store come into play for you along the way? How did you get involved in that?
Well, when I moved up to the Upper Peninsula, it was pretty dire circumstances up there. The mines had just closed, and everybody was out of work. It was like 20% unemployment, and trying to find a job was pretty tough. So I started bartending.
Okay.
And from bartending, it kind of grew into being kind of a booker, part owner of a little club up there. And, of course, started sitting with the bands. And one day a guy came in that was what they used to call rat jobbers. He used to put in all the K-Tel records in
right.
the grocery stores. And he serviced those, and I started working with him.
Okay.
And from that, I bought some record racks from Montgomery Ward store in Marquette and stored those and got ready and opened up a little 700-square-foot store in Iron Mountain, Michigan. So that's how the record store started,
yeah,
and that
yeah.
just kind of grew from there. But that was an unusual trip. It was kind of tough. You know, of course, everybody's out of work.
Sure.
But everything was kind of cheap, too, and you could make mistakes. And playing music was always actually a paying proposition. So that always helped. And we had two kids, and my wife's a nurse. So we kind of carved out a living up there for about a dozen years.
So you're pretty much a music lifer then. It's never been.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's funny. People ask you, what was your first concert? And I think my first one that I can remember anyway was Dick Clark's Caravan of Stars.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And at the International Amphitheater in Chicago, and I went with my babysitter that was supposed to take care of me, put me on the back of a motorcycle. And
we went down
to see Danny and the Juniors. That's who I remembered anyway. But,
yeah. Wow.
But it's been a long, long time.
When did songwriting become part of the life for you as well?
Boy, that's even hard to pinpoint. I was always, I know I've written stuff that when I was 7 years old, stories and whatever. So I was always writing stuff. Songwriting just came with the guitar in the mid-60s because... you know, you had Bob Dylan and all those people I started admiring and I wanted to do what they were doing. And I think even now I have a whole genre of people that watch me play and think that, well, if that guy can do it, I can do it too. So, it's a whole subset of performers in Chicago.
Yeah. but, do you... Do you start with the lyric, the idea, or do you start with the melody? How does that process begin for you?
Well, you know, I've always been a word guy, so it would start with lyrics. But the more I play and sit here and doodle around with the guitar, you know, you hear a lick, and you kind of incorporate that. A lot of my songs, when I start doing them, they are very different than the way they wind up on record.
Mm-hmm.
Even the before the band comes in, but they kind of grow and phrases get sharpened and licks start getting thrown in there, and you start bringing bridges, and sometimes bridges and choruses from other places start showing up.
Right.
And, but it's kind of honed through performance.
Okay.
And you know, people like something, and you continue to do that.
Sure.
And kind of work through that. But I would guess 80% of them probably start with lyrics, but kind of get groove oriented after a while. So.
Do you do some writing for other musicians as well, or is this predominantly just for your own purposes?
Basically, you know, I've. Basically just my stuff. This new record has a bunch of, well, one song is called Seven Days a Week, that the lyrics were written by a guy named Bob Frank out of California.
Uh-huh.
He was recorded by Jim Dickinson in the 70s, and he's been at it for a long, long time, too. But he just sent me these lyrics, and so I had approached it from a totally different way, different challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, usually people come up with their melody and want me to put words to it. But yeah, I would do that.
Yeah, but, sure, okay.
That's kind of easy, but the other way is kind of, let's see what we can do with this. Try and make it fit and
yeah.
Try and get after what he was after. So.
Sure, yeah. Well, I was reading over some of the notes that you sent over, and this... this phrase popped out at me, and I think maybe it was your guitarist that suggested this, or maybe someone in the studio, but that your music, they called it outsider Americana.
Yeah. I know we were, with this album in particular, I'm just sitting listening to it, and it's kind of a diversity of... you know, the first couple of albums, you could listen to it and, well, this is a blues song, this is a rock song, this is maybe even a jazz song, this
uh-huh.
is a country song. But I was just listening to it, and I blurted out, I said, what kind of music is this? And he came up with Outsider Americana. I said, well, I guess that's as good a phrase as any.
Did you make him tell you what that meant?
I kind of understood, I guess. You know, if you're familiar with the artist, Howard Fincher, I think his name is,
uh-huh.
but he was kind of the outsider artist, and I think he's down in Tennessee, somewhere down there, but he has all these sculptures outside of the things he just threw together, and, you know, where does this fit? And the thing is, you know, you just make it fit. You know, where did Bob Dylan fit?
Sure, yeah.
When he started, he wasn't exactly somebody that was going to rival Perry Como or somebody.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He just did what he had to do, and he became Bob Dylan. And,
yeah, right.
That's kind of what I'm after. So if
sure.
it's Outsider Americana, or I don't know, Irving Berlin, I don't know.
Well, you know, Americana has kind of become this huge umbrella where if your music doesn't fit anywhere else, you'll just slide it under the Americana umbrella because that's where everything else fits. And it just really caught me funny when it said Outsider Americana. And I was thinking, well, okay, so now maybe we're creating a new genre. Even. So if you can't fit under that umbrella, we've got this other one called Outside Americana.
Yeah.
I like that,
yeah,
though. That's cool.
You know, I was using Roots for a while, too. And what is that, you know?
Yeah, right.
of course, you know, we were born and raised in the United States, so I don't know. It's just, you can't say it's not the United States music. You
right.
can't say it's,
yeah.
it's not Roots. So what? How do you define this?
Sure, yeah. Well, and of course we want to talk about the new CD, Diamonds and Televisions, and you tell a story in the notes about how the title of that came to be. I wanted you to retell that for us, because I thought that was so cool.
Okay, well, a lot of times, I have working titles, and sometimes they turn out to be the title, but this one it was kind of, a collection I called Number 5 for a while, so it didn't really have a title, but I was down in Shawnee, Oklahoma, with a couple of my good friends down there, and they wanted to take me to a place called the Hamburger King, which was a hamburger restaurant that had been there since the 20s in downtown Shawnee. And it's a cool little place where you sit in the booth and you pick up an old rotary dial phone and phone in your order to the waitress, and she brings it by for you. and it was a pretty cool little place, and I really enjoyed it. But right across the street, there was a couple abandoned buildings, and one of them, I know they advertised they would take your pelt in, I guess. Whatever you killed, you could bring your pelt in and trade it for something. But next to it, there was an old pawn shop, and he covered the bases with that, with diamonds and televisions, cameras and stereos. And I said, well, that's kind of like my collective song here.
Yeah.
And we did take a couple pictures of it with the cell phone, and it didn't quite work for the title, but I passed them along to a friend who's not related, but his name is Luke Felton, F-E-L-T-O-N, opposed to my Ian.
Uh-huh.
And he did a great cover for me.
Yeah. That's cool.
So,
I
love
that story.
How that came about, and it stuck. It seems to fit quite a bit.
Yeah. So tell me some more about the CD itself, what's your looking at some of the names of the songs? Maybe it was intentional, but knowing that story, it's almost like, well, maybe you're going to tell some stories about some people who might have shopped at that pawn shop.
Well, a lot of my whole performances is stories. I do pick up, I'm kind of a history buff too. I work at I've been volunteering at the Chicago History Museum for 8 years.
Oh, cool.
I do a thing on Native Americans for the Field Museum. I'm kind of aware of what's gone before, and, some of these phrases that people come up with, in diners and wherever I am, I kind of have a way to make it into my stage show and kind of make it into the CDs. One of them on here is Emma's House, where I just happened to find out a house in an old neighborhood where I used to live, on the second floor, I believe it was Emma Goldman, the old anarchist, had lived there for a while.
Hmm.
And I said, wow, I walked by this place forever and never even thought about this.
Right.
We went out there and stood there and took a look at it. And as I was thinking about Emma Goldman, she was actually arrested in that apartment because a man had listened to her in had assassinated the president.
Wow.
And so they hauled her in, couldn't tie her to that, but they did deport her, and they never let her back in the country until after she was dead.
Hmm.
And they took her ashes and buried them here.
Hmm.
But, it's just things that you walk by every day, and you can never, ever, never imagine this until you actually knew the story behind that.
Yeah.
And the third verse is kind of disjointed in that one, because it's as I was standing there, I met an old girlfriend who had I hadn't seen in a long time, but she had been living with a guy that keeps hitting her, and she had her blackened eye at the time.
Oh, my gosh.
Kind of tied into Emma Goldman and the whole current history with past history and where are we going with all of this. You know,
yeah.
So that kind of became a story there. But I don't know. There's we can go through one by one. I can tell you a story about everything, just about. But
when you're performing, do you set it up? Do you tell the story before you do the song?
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, I do that. You know, it depends. You know, I play so many places that there are places where it's not conducive to telling stories. You just sit up there and play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I play a lot of you know, neighborhood bars, and these guys don't want you to be talking. They want you to just play the music.
Yeah.
Sometimes you want to dance, and sometimes you want to listen.
Yeah. But, right.
Preferably. I tell them the longer I talk, the less I play, and that might benefit you.
What's a full schedule these days look like for you playing music?
Oh well, I do between 60 and 100 gigs a year.
Okay.
Getting to be more and more. I know I told somebody that, and so I do 280 or something. So I guess I could do more, but I do. I have a couple of residencies where I play once a month, a place called Phyllis's Musical Lounge that has been around for forever. Dean Autry used to busk outside, and Nelson Algren used to live upstairs.
That's
and,
cool.
Anybody in Chicago has probably played there at one point or another. It's kind of a starter bar, but it's a fun bar, and I kind of like that.
Yeah.
And then I do a coffee house gig, the Buzz Cafe in Oak Park, where I just sit on my stool with the guitar, no amplification, and go through all these songs and stories and work things out. But I do play a whole lot of different places. I play rock clubs, I play punk clubs, I'll do farmers markets. They have Make Music Chicago, where you play different areas in Chicago, under the bridge and at the beach, and at the zoo, and any kind of club, any kind of restaurant. But I just enjoy getting out and playing before an audience, and most anywhere I'll do.
Are you predominantly still regional, or are you doing some national touring as well? Are you going to hit some festivals? Do you do that kind of work as well?
I do basically through the Midwest. I know I'll be going to Detroit this year. They have a thing called the Assembly Line Concert that they've done four different things. It's the longest. They've been in the Guinness World Record for the longest continuous concert. It goes for like 3-4 weeks.
Wow.
Around the clock. And I've done four of those. Originally it started when Detroit was really in dire straits with the auto industry, and Ford would bring their cars and GM would bring their cars, Chrysler would show up, the UAW would be there, the governor would show up, and it was kind of a celebration of what Detroit was and what it could be. And as things turned, the concerts kind of turned too.
Mm.
This one seems kind of political, and where they want Detroit and Michigan to go. They kind of started an assembly line, a party, like a political party. So we'll see what that is, but in 4 weeks, I'm sure they can cover everybody's bases.
Yeah.
But I do Bob Everhart. He's old Smithsonian Folkways recording artist. I've had a festival for 40 years out in Mars, Iowa, called National Traditional Country, and probably just about everything else out there. And he does that every year in August. And I've done about 4 or 5 of those.
That's cool.
We'll be out there this year. Basically, nothing is amplified. You can stand in front of a microphone, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so again, the album is Diamonds and Televisions, and we've been talking to Mike Felton. Mike, tell everybody how they can get in touch with you, find your music, reach out if they want to send you a note or ask questions. What's the best way to get in touch and find your CDs?
Okay, well, my website is www.mikefelton.com. It's F-E-L-T-E-N. There's another Mike Felton, F-E-L-T-O-N, but he's a young baseball player with long blonde hair, okay. And he weighs about 195 pounds. But after that, that's where the similarities end. And,
right.
you know it's not me. But MikeFelton.com is one place where you can find anything. I'm on Reverb Nation. Most of my stuff is up on Spotify, CD Baby, all the usual suspect iTunes. Not that hard to get a hold of. If you just Google me or drop me an email, you can do that. Everything should be on the website.
Okay.
And I'm on Facebook. You can befriend me there, too. So
great.
we're all over the place.
Yeah, good.
Or just invite me to your house. I'd be happy to.
Yeah, we'd do a house concert, right?
Sure. Yeah. That'd be great.
Great. Well, thanks, Mike. I appreciate it. Good talking to you today.
Okay. Sounds great.
Thanks again for tuning in to this episode of Americana Music Profiles. Find us on iTunes at Americana Music Profiles and on the internet at AmericanaRhythm.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Jabbers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.